there's a place for an accurate accounting system in the world of physical things, money and coal and timber and square footage. There's a place for that. But in the domain of kindness, leadership, experience, love, and reputation, and all of these human, non-physical things, that kind of accounting system doesn't work.
Hi, I'm Wyatt.
And I'm Grace.
And you're listening to Our Dad and your host of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore, and we're back with our Experts Corners and interviews with experts around the short-term rental world. And you guys know that once in a while, I bring in somebody that really catches my attention that's outside of our vacation rental world. And today, I've got the great pleasure of introducing and joining us on this conversation, Mr. John David Mann. And, you know, John, I'm super excited about this conversation. Before we hit record, I said, you know, is there anything off limits? And you said, heck no, let's talk a little about everything that we want to go down. And you have a very diverse background. The way that I'm introduced to John David Mann, and many of you might know him, is, you know, an international best-selling author. I like, how many books, John? You've got over 40 books, probably,
yeah, 40
right?
plus.
You know,
yeah,
I was introduced to you through reading the Go-Giver series. And so, like, I love the Go-Giver series. I know that was a very successful series for you guys when you started off. But that's what kind of my introduction to you was, because I was such a fan of that series of books, and then started peeling back the layers of the onion. And there's a lot more that makes up Mr. John David Mann than just that series of books, right?
It's a weird onion. Yeah.
I love it. Well, listen, I want to, you know, I'd love to just kind of start with your backstory and background, and make sure you don't skip over that age 16 to 17, because I'm super interested in that one.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about, you know, your backstory, and then you and I'll have a good conversation about, we talked about kind of, you have always been a disruptor, and yeah. We talked about how the short-term rental world and the hospitality world has really disrupted the hospitality business in general. But I mean, you really, like you said, like your background when I was reading it and stuff, it's like you didn't have really any intentions of being this business leader and teacher and, you know, an author. And it just, but it's grown into such this business for you and these topics, you know, especially with the books that I've read and been introduced to. But let's not start right there. Let's start with the background.
Yeah. Well, I mean, disruption, you know, I think at our mother's knee, when we first heard the word disruption, it was like a negative thing, right? It's a problem, a disruption. And I think you and I both think of it more as like the opportunity for reinvention. Because I've been, for some reason, reinventing myself since I was a kid. I don't know why. I don't know where it came from. But I will say I was one of those baby boomers who's my parents said, you can do anything you want to do. You can do anything you aspire to do. And for some reason, I believed them. I don't know why. I had a pretty clear start. It just got muddy along the way. I was kind of like, my life has been kind of like a ping pong game. I started out as a classical musician. I was going to play the cello. I was a composer. And then my curiosity and my interest just kind of led me everywhere. When I was 13, my mom was taking a class of us to Greece. She was a school teacher. She was taking us to Greece to perform a play in Greek theater, ancient Greek theater. And she said, and she decided she wanted a bunch of the choruses in the play set to music. And she turned to me and said, you compose the music for that. And I was like, hey, dude, I'm 13. I don't know how to do that. She said, sure you can. So I did. And that was the beginning. That music won some prizes and I was off for a career as a composer. But then I got interested in sales. I got interested in nutrition. I got interested in all kinds of things. And I kept, you know, kind of following my nose. When I was 16, I guess 17, a bunch of my school friends and I were disaffected with the schools where we were ensconced. It's like, we're not learning anything. We're not doing anything. It just felt like kind of a brick building babysitting. And, we didn't want to, this was like around the time of the free school movement, and we didn't want to drop out and do nothing. We wanted to drop out and do everything.
Right.
We want a place where we can actually learn something, or we can learn things that we're going to use in our lives. So I dropped out of school and we started a school. And, I spent my junior year of school, a high school, working on starting this school.
Yeah.
We hired a director and a bunch of us kids were kind of the spearheading it. And then I spent my senior year at that school, and I graduated and I went on to teach at that school. And, you know, Sean, we were an alternative school. We had no accreditation. We had no, a certification from any kind of body, state, fed, otherwise. And we sent some of our graduates on to Harvard, Yale, state colleges around the country. Our graduates did things.
Yeah.
And I guess it was my first experience, although I didn't know the word at the time, of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah. So when I read that part of it, it was really interesting because I felt like when COVID started hitting and there's some things going on in our world today, I feel like that there's another type of a movement of saying, hey, listen, a lot of our schools are just, they're just like daycares essentially, right? There's places kids are going to go. And like, we've always homeschooled our kids. We've always kind of felt like that. Mm-hmm. And wanted our kids, not in that system necessarily to learn how to be employees. We wanted them to go do things, right? We wanted them to be exposed to all kinds of different things that the schools just didn't even have the resources to help them, kind of follow their nose, as you said, right? And be able to, because, we lived in a small rural town and they just don't have resources for a lot of extracurricular stuff. So we're like, hey, listen, we're going to start homeschooling. Yeah. And then COVID hit and people started doing a little bit more of the homeschooling and then these alternative type of learning environments. And it's very interesting to me, like when I was reading that about, like, it's no surprise when I read that about, what you were doing. And then it's like, hey, listen, we're going to take action. We're going to be entrepreneurs. We're going to start this school because we not that we don't want to be in school and learn. We want to learn.
Right.
We're just not getting offered the same things or the things that we're maybe interested in. And or was it more of an interest or the lack of resources? Like, I'm curious what for us, it was lack of resources that ultimately spurred us pulling our kids out of school and saying, hey, we're going to do this on our own. And then we started realizing the real benefits of it. But I'm curious for you, was it lack of resources? Was it lack of options? Was it just saying, hey, listen, we want to run down a different road.
Yeah. It wasn't lack of options for us as much as it was. We had a bunch of my friends and I had gone to some sort of funky arts oriented private schools and where we had a very creative life. And then we found ourselves in high school in our local public high schools that weren't terrible. I guess I would use the word mediocre. It was just kind of like nothing exciting, nothing going on. It's kind of the inevitable decay of an institution over time.
Yeah.
As it becomes more and more set in its ways and responds less and less to the spirit of innovation that created it. It happens in every industry. It happens in every kind of human organization. And so human organizations by nature have to be constantly being reborn, reinvented, or they lose their, their flavor, their juice, their jazz. Mm-hmm. So it was boredom.
Yeah.
Boredom and the desire to do interesting things. That first semester when I was a senior in that school, we had, like 45 kids in the school. We had 50 different courses and we were going to courses, all day, every day, from computer programming to nutrition, to philosophy, to English literature, all this stuff, that a lot of that we couldn't get in our high schools.
Right.
So it was the desire to make stuff happen.
Right. Love it. And that led to, I'm assuming, cause you do have a very diverse background, like you mentioned, like whether it's, whether it's the arts, whether it's business, whether it's nutrition, all these different avenues, and ultimately a foundation, when did you start getting interested in writing? Right. When did you start to say, hey, listen, I'm interested in taking this and putting it into books, right? Like when did the writing start to happen for you?
Calling my background diverse is very kind, Sean. I appreciate that. You could use the word confused,
right?
In the various things that I did, starting schools and being involved, as I say, in nutrition and in teaching that, and in some alternative health organizations and in some sales organizations, I always seem to be the guy writing the newsletter or editing the article or making the poster. Or I was always the guy that my buddies turned to say, hey, make this read better.
Right.
And so I kind of slid into it. I never had a plan like I'm going to be a writer. Some friends and I started a journal that was about direct sales, in the direct sales business. And it was my job to take articles submitted by people who really didn't know how to write but had something to say and turn them into good writing. I have a book called How to Write Good. Yeah. That was my job, how to make this stuff gooder.
Yeah.
And so I spent 10 years in that and a couple of subsequent publications, periodicals. I got involved in an environmental and health journal, and I was the guy producing all the articles, either editing or I spent 10 years editing other people's stuff. And out of that, I started actually co-writing books with people like the Go-Giver you mentioned.
Yeah.
My buddy, Bob Berg, I had edited articles of his in our journal. And he came to me and said, listen, you write my stuff better than I write my stuff. I have this idea for a book, but I know I can't write it. I got you. Will you write it? You write it with me.
Yeah.
So our deal was, John, you write it. Me, Bob, I'll promote it.
Yeah.
And we've had, you know, probably the most fruitful professional relationship of my life since then. And that just spread out to other people. I was helping people write books. And eventually I realized, oh, my gosh, this is what I do. I write books.
Right.
I only recently turned to novels, as you know, and thrillers. And my God, that's a fantastic world. Starting to write my own books that are not co-written with somebody else. And it's just been a lot of fun journey.
So talk to me about the co-authorship and co-writing. Yeah. when you rolled into it. So you would say, okay, there's these different people who have these different ideas and these different voices and, you know, that need to be heard, but they don't really know how to put it out there. So you're going to help them articulate these, you know, this outline that's in their head. Right. And yeah. Make it to where somebody can digest it and say, hey, listen, this is really awesome. And in a lot of your books were co-written, in that arrangement. Was that just a natural because of your, like, okay, because I'm editing all this stuff and, you know, I'm the, you know, polishing all this stuff up. That was probably the comfort level at first till you started realizing, hey, listen, I can do this stuff on my own as well. Right. And I can write some of this stuff on my own. Because I did know, like, I noticed a lot of the books are co-written and you are the co-author on a lot of them with somebody else. Was that intentional or was that just, that's just kind of how it evolved for you?
It was two things. It evolved as on the one hand, it was natural. It was a natural creative direction. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that I would work somebody who he had a certain outline in his head. Actually, that was typically the problem. He didn't have an outline in his head. Mm. I work with people who they had experience. They had a life. You know, they maybe had a professional expertise. Yeah. They were experts in leadership or in business or in some aspect of some field, or they had a fascinating life. But they didn't have any outline or way to structure it or, you know, I tell my students that a memoir is a novel that just happens to be true.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is you don't sit down and just write out everything that happened in your life. And that's interesting. That's boring. That's like nothing. To create a compelling, fascinating, gripping kind of memoir, you have to take a person's life and say, okay, what's the story here? What's the arc? What's the journey? What's the experience that I, as a reader, want to go through reading it? So I come out at the end a changed person. So writing a memoir for somebody else is a little bit like taking their life and saying, okay, we're going to use that as the raw material for a novel, which we're now going to write. So give you an example, my buddy Brandon Webb, who's a former Navy SEAL. He was a Navy SEAL sniper. In fact, he was the guy who trained the Navy SEAL snipers for a number of years. Head instructor. And Brandon wanted to write a memoir, but he knew that he needed a writer to help him do it. So I got hired and we formed a partnership. I wrote the book, did really well, called The Red Circle, New York Times bestseller. And we loved working together. We kind of clicked, even though I'm a cellist and he's a sniper, not the same thing, but we clicked on a lot of basic principles around excellence and leadership and workmanship. So we went on, wrote a bunch of other memoirs. And then he came to me and said, you know, I've had this idea for a novel I've had for over a decade based on an experience I had on an aircraft carrier. Would you be interested in writing a novel? I was like, you kidding? I'm in. And I thought, crap, I don't know how to write a novel. I was totally intimidated. That had always seemed to me like an impossible thing. How do these guys write these 400-page books when they make it up out of their head? How that worked was I did a bunch of interviews with him on the phone mostly. Some in person. I pulled information from him about what it's like to be in an aircraft carrier. And then we kind of brainstormed a few big plot ideas. And then I was off and running. And this is basically how I do it. I was off and running and, you know, turn off the phone, turn off the email, and I'll write the book as if it were completely my own. It's kind of like stepping into somebody's shoes. If you were an actor, you're going to play, you know, Mr. Rogers, you're Tom Hanks playing Mr. Rogers or whatever. You step into that person's shoes and live their life. That's kind of what writing that kind of book is. I step into this idea of a novel and write it. So it's, I said it's a creative direction. It's also kind of my business model that I developed, which is I write the book, you promote it.
Right.
I have discovered in my later years that that's not always a workable plan. Actually, it doesn't work to say as an entrepreneur, I'm going to do these creative things and not dirty my brain up with worries about marketing and sales and promotion. It doesn't really work that way.
Right.
What I've discovered is, as a writer, yeah, you need to know how it works to promote, to market, to sell.
Yeah.
And so I've you know taken on that burden for myself to learn a lot more about how that works.
Yeah, that's it's interesting because right at the end of the day, you are still an entrepreneur, or a promoter, and everything
you
else that goes along with that. When you have that book that you need to get in the hands of somebody else. And while we're on the topic of books, I wrote a book back in 2019. It took me and you mentioned the outline part of it. That was the hardest part for me, right? Because I was trying to write a book about my blueprint of how we go about like these three major phases of investing in short-term rentals, right? And so something I do all day, every day. I've done it for a long time. And I thought, oh, this would be really easy. It was really, really difficult for me.
Isn't that wild?
It took me almost a year, and I still I'm proud of the book, but I don't consider myself an author. Like I should have had probably, you know, even more help than I did. And I was back then the ChatGPT and the AI and stuff was not like it is today, but I'm so anti, AI written books. In fact, I think most of them, I feel like they're just, all they're doing is regurgitating whatever they can find online. Right. It's just not, to me, it's just not, they're not that good.
They're telling you what you want to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but trying to take something that I did every day that we did for years, I've been full-time real estate investing for almost three decades now, 27 years. And then actually articulate it into an outline and a blueprint and, you know, a process and that made sense to people and actually was compelling enough to like keep their interest with stories of how things work. It was really hard. I mean, it was really difficult for me to do something that I thought was going to be, I'm like, I could write this in a week, right? I'm like,
it took me
a year and a half.
Yeah. That's amazing. You just put your finger, you said that so well. That is, you put your finger exactly on what I've discovered my skill set is. That's what I do for people is I figure out a structure for what they know.
Mm-hmm.
You get experts who do stuff flawlessly, but they don't know exactly how to explain what they do because they've never had to reverse engineer it and turn it into a blueprint for themselves. To turn around and teach that, it's like I teach this one-year writing program for writers.
Yeah.
It's a coaching course. And people have asked me, why did you start this program? Be honest, half of it is selfish. It's like, because when I teach, I learn how I write.
Yeah.
I learn how it works. And so that is a lot of it, whether I'm writing nonfiction for somebody else or I'm writing fiction. It's taking something and figuring out the bones of it, the skeleton, the framework. It's like what Leonardo da Vinci did when he drew sketches of human figures, you know, before he would paint them. Where's the joints? Where's the knees? Where's the elbows? You know?
Yeah, it was, we have a Vodacy, which is a coaching program and everything. But when I
love the name,
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners have heard the story of our name, and I was telling you that before we hit hit recording. So
totally dig it.
Yeah, and it's but at the time I was writing this book at the time when I was thinking about teaching people. The whole point of my book was really trying to. Like, because you can do something, but doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate to be able to teach somebody else how to do what you're doing, right? And so that was the whole point of the book when I originally wrote it, was this outline. But then it formed into an actual coaching program because we took so much time to really compartmentalize the blueprint and the process and the outline and everything else. And then it formed into what Vodacy is today, which is, you know, the largest short-term rental investing coaching company in the US. And it started with this little book and trying to figure out how to take what we had done all the time in our professional careers of investing in these assets, articulating it well enough and kind of putting down a recipe or a blueprint, if you will, for somebody to follow. But then we just, you know, you just try to articulate it over time and we're like, yeah, that makes sense. And then ultimately people learn how to do it and it turns into even more than just the book, similar to a lot of the books that you have written, right? And you're saying that, listen, I'm going to take these concepts and I'm going to outline them out. And ultimately, you know, somebody can read them. And like you mentioned, you talk about impact and influence and being able to say, you know, how can you go out? And I think you say you want to how can you change the world? Right. What can I do to change the world? Right. And you say it doesn't mean you have to be on the New York Times bestseller. How can you make an impact for one person, 10 people, 1,000 people, whatever it is, and they can change their course of their life. And that's what we really tried to do with our outline. And I mentioned that because I know that's what you help people do. You help them get this skill sets and this knowledge out of them to, you know, in a way that somebody can not only consume it, but it can have an impact in their own lives to where they can now go out. You can pass the baton to somebody and they can run faster and farther than we've ever run. That's the goal, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the you know, the breakout books of the 90s in the whole realm of leadership and personal development was Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Yeah. And, you know, what Covey did was he kind of broke it down to a set mm-hmm. of like, give me something I can count on my fingers and that I can remember. And, you know, all the Go-Giver books, you mentioned those Go-Giver books, mm-hmm. every one of them, there's five of them now. They each one is based on five principles. And I call them like four fingers and a thumb because the first four are all kind of similar in some ways. And the fifth one seems like it's opposite, but it's what makes them work.
Right.
And, you know, and that's that kind of framework. That's the essential skill set, I think, of creating a book. I'm talking nonfiction now.
Right.
Creating a book like yours that gives people a structure they can hang on to and remember.
Right. And let's talk about the concept of the Go-Giver, because I think it's talked about a lot. I think it's harder for people to actually execute, if you will, of this. Hey, listen, there's this basic law of reciprocity is what the way that I think about it. Like, hey, listen, I'm going to go lead with value. I'm going to lead with, you know, like giving before I intend to receive. And I think a lot of it is, okay, I'm just going to give. And what if I never receive? That's not the point of it, right? That's not the point of the books, right? The book is saying, hey, listen, There's this kind of universal law out there that the more you give, the more you're going to receive. And, it also can't be, okay, I'm going to give today and I'm not going to give again until I receive, right? That's not how it works. Right. And so talk to me a little bit about that concept. We are huge at Vodacy about leading with value. We teach investors to do this, saying, hey, listen, every consumer has this cost versus value equation and like weight going on before they spend a dollar on anything. If you can give a lot of value in the first, before they even pay you a dollar, they're way more likely to pay you more dollars, right? And they're way more likely to say, hey, listen, I'm getting this value already. What if I pay this and I get even more value? And or I pay a dollar and I got $10 worth of value. You think you're going to retain them as customers? Yes, right? And so my takeaways from those books is let's lead with as much value as possible. And the consumer is going to say, hey, listen, not only are you going to attract me, you're going to convert me, but you're also going to retain me as a customer. And that's ultimately business, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then that the science, if you will, or maybe call it the art and science of retaining customers, building lifetime customers is a whole like branch of being a Go-Giver for sure. It's a key thing. You know, Bob Proctor, there's a character in the Go-Giver book, Pindar, who's kind of the mentor. And he's loosely based on the guy named Bob Proctor. Yeah. And Bob Proctor used to say, and I think that he got it from Earl Nightingale, actually, and Pindar says it in the book, you can say to the fireplace, give me some heat, and then I'll put on the logs.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
No.
How it works is you put on the logs, and you get them going, and then you're going to get the heat.
Yeah.
Elsewhere in the book, we say that money is the echo of value. It's like the thunder to value's lightning.
Yeah.
The value that you give is the lightning, and lightning comes back as thunder. Well, money is thunder. And I think to make the go-giver thing, the idea of the go-giver is not that to be a nice person and a good person, you should be generous. Like that's like, yeah, I mean, that's lovely, but that's not really what we're saying. What we're saying is that exactly what you said, if you put your focus on giving value to other people, the other person, you're going to get taken care of.
Yeah.
You have to. It works that way. And to be able to and it's, and you can't meter it in a one-to-one accounting system, because it's asynchronous.
Yes.
You may not be getting the payback, so to speak, the moment you give the value. It's like putting logs in the fireplace. Yeah. It's like investing money in a bank account. In order to really kind of adopt the go-giver mindset and have that be part of your operating principle so that it actually works, and you don't just like give your stuff away for free and go broke, which is not our idea. For it to work, you have to sort of develop this fundamental faith in the universe, kind of fundamental faith in the idea that life is looking out for you. So if you have a sort of a cynical, hard-bitten, dog-eat-dog mentality, it's really weird, this go-giver idea. It doesn't fit. You have to kind of melt that and embrace the idea that life is really designed in your favor.
Yeah.
And so it is a very pragmatic business principle. It's not a principle of altruism as much as it's a principle, as you say, of reciprocity.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how I view it as well. Like, yeah, it's not this, not that, you know, being a good person and giving and taking care of others is a bad thing by any stretch, right? We do, you know, people do that and that's great.
Yeah.
At the end of the day though, there's this energy in the universe that I'm a huge believer of, right? And the more value and the more you give back, and it's not an equitable exchange. It's almost never equitable, right? It's not like you're going to usually get back way more than you ever give, but it's leading with that value first. And then the universe is going to pay you back with a lot of different ways, maybe monetarily. But you can't sit and wait for it. It's like, like you said, there's a faith, a belief and a faith behind it that fuels this. And
yes,
and it's just, and it compounds, right? It's like a snowball that's compounding. And that's what's so fun about it and why I buy into this concept, like hook, line and sinker.
Yeah. You say it really, really well. You've so absorbed, adapted and adopted. There's a place for an accurate accounting system in the world of physical things, mm-hmm. money and coal and timber and square footage. There's a place for that. But in the domain of kindness, leadership, experience, love, and reputation, and all of these human, non-physical things, that kind of accounting system didn't work.
Right.
We have one of the Go-Giver books my wife and I wrote called The Go-Giver Marriage. And there's a line in there, a 50-50 marriage is a formula for failure.
Yeah.
And 50-50 isn't like, well, I washed the dishes last night, so it's your turn this night. Yeah. That isn't how a successful marriage is going to go. And that also isn't how a successful business relationship is going to go. Yeah. And people get confused about that because, well, what about accounting? Yeah. Right. You pay, you credit, you charge, you have accounts receivable. You keep all the accounting of the physical stuff clear and accurate. But in the domain of human exchange, it's a whole different physics going on.
Yeah.
And it's based on giving, 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 giving. It's the same principle of love. Yeah. You don't wait to get loved and then say, okay, I'll love you back.
Right.
That's not how it works.
It's not how it works. Right. But there's a lot of people that's how they're going to operate. Right. And that's okay. Everybody makes their own choices.
But it's limited.
It is. It's you know, I'm a huge fan of Napoleon Hill and a lot of Napoleon Hill's works. And he talks about that concept a lot. And really just being able to tap into this, you know, this, all of this energy that's out there, and there's not a limited amount of it. And that's what, you know, you have to have that abundance mindset, the faith, you know, living in, operating out of faith instead of fear is what he says a lot of times, which is the fear is very limited, right? It's like, hey, listen, if I do this, you have to do that. If you don't do that, I'm not doing this again. Right. And that's not how successful businesses operate. It's not how successful relationships operate. It's really, right. that's a difficult way to live your life. And, yeah. and when I, you know, and, you know, we could go off on this topic for a long time. I'm sure you and I could talk about this for a yeah. while, but that's what, like, on ultimately that concept and the way that you guys put that together in the Go Giver series of books. And I've read all of them. I haven't actually read the one, the Go Giver Marriage. I should read that one. That's, I'm 25 years. This year was my 25th anniversary. So I better go, you know, get all ready right. for that next 25. I need to go read that one, but I think I've read all the rest of them. And I love how you put the stories together in these parables, right? And you have these characters and talk to me a little bit. I'm curious about that. Like, rather than just being very factual and like nonfiction, yeah. which a parable is fairly nonfiction, right? It's still a concept that is, that you're trying to get across in this framework, but it's written in these parables. I love that you, like, I actually really like those types of books, like The Alchemist and some of those types of books that are written as parables, right?
Yeah. Yeah, The Alchemist is amazing, right? It's on so many people's favorite book list. Yeah, I just love writing parables. It really is a joy. And it's interesting because a parable is so different from a novel. In a novel, you explain a lot. Yeah. In a novel, you give a lot of information, description, background, motivation, what's going on internally. In a parable, you leave most of that out. It's a very stripped down kind of abstract version of it's like a mini novel almost. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The idea of it, I think, is that people really learn most, and particularly just not learning facts, but learning ideas, learning new ways of looking at things, learning new ways of doing things, learning bigger pieces. Yeah. People learn that stuff through emotion. They don't just learn by being told. Yeah. So you may have, in a great parable, you might be able to fit the teaching. The basic teaching that you want to deliver onto three or four pages, maybe onto two pages.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the parables in the Bible is kind of the same deal. We've been using parables since we could tell stories right. on cave walls. It's one thing to explain something to somebody, like, you know, look at, put value, other person's, you know, interest first, and you'll be taken care of. Always have a focus on value for other people. Okay, yep. Great. I just said that in like a paragraph.
Right.
But when it's a story, then the reader enters into it and identifies with the character and goes through the experience, through the hopes and through the aspirations and through the challenges and through the struggles and the fear and all of the emotional baggage and experience that goes with a journey through challenge and ultimate victory. They come out of that book. It's like they lived it.
Right.
It sticks to you when you live it. It's like, how often have we heard our parents say, we come and tell our parents something that we just learned. They say, yeah, I've been telling you that since like you were this high, but now you just learned it from your friend.
Right, right.
Yeah, I learned it from my friend because I experienced it differently. Uh-huh. Well, that's what a parable is. It's a way to have somebody experience a principle so that they come out of it. They laugh, they cry. I'll tell you, when I'm writing a parable, I know it's not done yet if I haven't cried.
Yeah.
Also, if I haven't belly laughed, it's like you got to go through human experience. And when you're writing it, so that people will when they read it. And I when they're really well written, I will say this, Sean, it's easy to write a shallow parable that doesn't quite work. And, you know, those of us who write parables, we struggle because it's the kind of thing that looks really easy on the surface, but it's kind of, it's as difficult as a novel.
Yeah.
In some ways more so, because you're trying to do more with fewer tools.
Do you help people, like in your courses and writing? Is there a framework to learn parable writing? I'm asking selfishly because I couldn't agree more that storytelling and being able to, you know, that's what a parable is, right? It's taking a concept and telling a story, right? And like you say you're working on being a promoter and a marketer and everything else. And so are we, right? We always are. And I'm like, okay, this skill set could be really, really valuable in articulating what we have to offer in a way that has like telling a story of how it works. So I'm asking selfishly, and we'll kind of lead into kind of how you help people. And this is a good segment to that, right? Because I know you do help
awesome segue,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. So in my coaching program, I've got people who are writing novels. I've got people who are writing, you know, big how-to books, but I also have a bunch of people who are writing parables, not surprisingly, I guess, because it's like what I do. So yeah, it's funny because when I set the program up, I thought long and hard, does this make sense to do a program in accepting people who are writing fiction and nonfiction?
Yeah.
And I thought about, should it be two different programs? Should I split? And I took a look at my own experience and I realized, you know, it doesn't matter. There are some distinctions. If you're writing a memoir, you're writing a cookbook, you're writing a travel book, sure, you're writing historical fiction. There are distinctions. And because I've wrestled with a lot of those different media and forms, I kind of know what those are, but there's like 85, 90% of it is the same across all books. It's basic storytelling. It's figuring out what your content is, like we were saying earlier, and finding the structure in that that's going to make it come together. And then knowing how to craft your narrative prose so that it sings and so that reader sinks into it. And so, I mean, the shorter answer is, yeah, we do that a lot. I have a lot of people who come in to write one kind of book and end up writing a different kind of book.
Yeah.
Like they come in to write a parable, they end up writing a novel, or they came in to write a business book. I have one person writing my program right now who's writing a book about change in the corporate world and how leadership leadership can deal with change so it doesn't traumatize people. And when she was trying to figure out her kind of her core outline, she came down to this, she stumbled on this realization, which was, it's not change that's so hard. It's loss.
Mm-hmm.
And it completely changed how she presents her work to her clients. And she's got a pretty impressive business doing this with corporate clients. So just like for yourself, the process of figuring out how to write this book has changed what she does and how she does it for her clients. And that's not a parable, but you know, there's others who are doing parables.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. So how can people that are listening? I mean, there's a lot of our listeners that are, they maybe say, hey, listen, I've got this experience or this idea or whatever it is locked inside of me and I want to get it out. And I've been really thinking about this idea of a book and I actually want to write my book, not let AI write my book. And so,
right.
You know, right. And so it, for somebody who's listening, where do they find more about John David Mann and the help and services that you guys offer?
The simplest place is my website, which is just my name, johndavidmann.com.
Okay.
Awesome. I've got all my books there and I've got a page called, you know, /coaching. And on that coaching page, the basic program is there.
Perfect. Perfect. So we'll, as always, we will post those in the show notes, you guys, so you don't have to remember that, but that's a pretty easy one to remember. johndavidmann.com is with two N's on man. So that's a pretty easy one. So
I have a newsletter. I have a newsletter called Man's Search for Meaning and it's two N's on the man. So
love it. Love it.
And not hard to forget.
And that's the thing, that writing is such a skill set that, you know, that I have, you know, been so interested in myself, not necessarily because I want to be an author and write a whole bunch of books, but between emails and newsletters and one pagers on the marketing, when you have new products, everything else, just being able to articulate different things in short form and long form, all these different things. It's a skill set that is very easy to, one, think that we have the easy button with AI and, right, and which again, we didn't dive into that topic too much, but my opinion, my listeners know my opinion on AI because I see too much AI stuff put out there that in our world that I'm just like, oh man, they're going to walk into a buzzsaw if they actually try that. But
but talk to any editor, any publisher in New York and they'll agree with you.
Yeah. It's 100% has its uses, right? Research wise and different things wise. But when you actually try to actually go have it do some, you know, things that really take experience and knowledge, what if it spits out 85% everything is accurate, but that 15%, you don't know if you're not an expert in the space, and that not having that 15% of information could lead you down a completely wrong road.
And the wisdom behind the information.
Exactly. And so it becomes a little bit difficult. So, John, any last, like I always like to ask the last question of if you could go back and you could go back to your younger self and over the years learning all the different things you've learned, or whether it's a lesson learned or a piece of advice that you'd love to give your younger self, is there anything that comes to mind?
Floss.
I love it.
I think if I could go back to my 19-year-old self, I have a book out called The Vagrant. It's a leadership book. And in the center of the book, the hero is asked exactly that question, you know, right from Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. You know, I look at that kid, that dumb kid who committed that terrible crime, right? And I want to talk to him. If I look back at that dumb kid who committed that terrible crime, I think that, honestly, I would say, trust yourself, believe in yourself, but look for elders you can really learn from. Because I think that as a youth, I wasted a certain amount of time, forging my own path, but squandering my access to some amazing, brilliant people because I didn't trust their opinion or whatever. And I think that these two things are contradictions. Trust yourself. Yeah. Nobody in the universe knows better than you, except everybody else.
Right. I love that answer, by the way. And I think it goes not just, I mean, it's very easy when we're young to think we know everything, right? And when we look back, we're like, man, we were these cocky, you know, kids who thought we knew everything and didn't want to take advice from anybody. And but even when you get older, right? And, you know, successful people, they're leaders, they're hesitant to ask for advice. There's no reason to reinvent anything at this stage in the game, right? There are people that have run down the road before you that are willing to share the good, the bad, the ugly, and help you avoid some mistakes that they made and learned from, and help you accelerate your path forward. And just like I said earlier, pass that baton to you and run down the road further and farther than you know, they've ever been able to run. And being able to trust that and being able to say, hey, listen, okay, I am, you know, this disruptor. I am this person who is a free thinker. I am this person who is going to trust myself, but also acknowledge that there's been people that have been down the road before me and they're a few steps ahead of me and they made some mistakes that I don't necessarily need to recreate and make again. And like you said, it feels like a contradiction, but it's really not, because what you're really trying to do is just run further and farther than you know, and to your potential and further and farther than they've ever been able to run. And people are willing to pass that baton. And I think that
very willing.
And the older we get, I think that the more, you know, that we like, maybe it's our ego, maybe it's us saying, hey, listen, I'm already kind of successful in my own right. I don't want to look like I need extra help or this or that or the other. And that gets in the way of really you being able to accelerate your path forward. And I think it's a great piece of advice.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Mr. John David Mann, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. Those of you that are listening, I know you love these conversations. You guys tell us all the time. And so I hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did. And you got a lot of value out of this, this episode. And so you guys know we don't run ads. We don't run sponsorships. The only way this show grows is if you guys share it. And so if you have somebody else that you would like to share the show with, that you think that would be love to be a part of these types of conversations, share the show. Those things help us a lot. If you have more than 30 seconds, like it or review it on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. And the final, most important thing I ask you guys at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today to start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey, Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.